This is the Living Prophets Podcast, episode 36. So following up from last time, when we heard about effective activism.
So collective action is about altering the narrative in society. Individual witness is about interrupting conversations.
I really wanted to follow up, think more about the three things that embody effective activism. And going in the order of which people are usually thinking about this, the first part of being an effective activist is standing with the vulnerable, the abused, the overlooked, the victims, standing up for their rights, finding these people in your community. And Rob Hardy's of All Souls Church in Washington, D.C. explains exactly what that looks like in his sermon following the 2016 election.
I say all this because it's important that we acknowledge our common vulnerability and pay loving attention to the particular vulnerabilities among us as a community. Because there are some in our congregation and community whose identities have been specifically targeted by the hateful rhetoric of the president-elect and the people in his inner circle. There are members of our congregation who are Muslim. There are Black and Latino members of our congregation who worry that their lives may matter less in a Trump administration. Victims of sexual assault who in some cases have been re-traumatized because the nation just elected someone who boasted of sexual assault. There are queer people and trans people who fear. But if we can do this Sunday, if we can acknowledge our vulnerability and remind ourselves of our strength, then we will have accomplished what I've set out to accomplish. Friends, I've been thinking a lot since Tuesday about this idea of sanctuary, and we don't know what the future may bring. But today, I want us to promise that this congregation will provide sanctuary to all who are vulnerable and oppressed by the incoming administration. We will provide sanctuary for them. We are here for you. We are here for one another. Sanctuary. That is the promise that we make to one another today in our vulnerability, friends. That is one of the beautiful things that can come from the intersection of our vulnerability and our strength. Sanctuary.
The second duty is what we usually think about when people think of the word activist. It's about waking people up, raising public awareness about injustice that exists in our society and that people may have never noticed or have just grown blind to. And Reverend William Barber does a very good job of describing that.
We come now to the close of a year that has proven that we as a nation have a heart problem. And somebody's got to be willing to go all the way until there is a transformation. And we've seen again this year a theme which recurs too often in the American story, that every stride toward freedom is met by a backlash of hate and fear. My sisters and brothers, be clear tonight. This is nothing unprecedented in the American experience. I'm talking about the election, his appeal to the lesser angels of our nature, and the appeal of so many to those lesser angels is as American as apple pie. And let us be also equally clear that this is not just about a president. It's about an entire web of money and influence that has been working to tie up the American democracy and other countries around the world. And so we wrote Mr. Trump saying, we do not believe these ideas are left or right. They are right and wrong. That's the struggle. And we said, while we know no human being is perfect, we wish to speak to you about these moral issues because far too much is at stake for you to succumb to the worst demons that try to hijack our democracy. And we said to him, we wouldn't meet with him at the towers, but if he so chose, in a house of worship, because the role of moral leaders is not to make politicians of any party comfortable, but to challenge them and to critique them. Because some things we stand for no matter who's in office.
But the third, and I think most transformative aspect of being an activist, is more than just serving and protecting the vulnerable. It's more than just protesting and raising awareness and waking people up to some injustice. Definitely more than the civil disobedience, which is really around raising the cost to the state and to those in power for perpetrating injustice. No, for me, the most interesting and transformative way to be an activist is individual witness, is about living your life and never passing up an opportunity to call to attention the things that people think and say without really realizing the ramifications every day. For example, 3 years ago, Brother Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, was attacked by a young gunman. And the next day, the families of the victims were asked to come to a hearing about bail. This is what they have to say. I wish I could find an audio segment of this, but couldn't. So I'm just going to read their statements. We welcomed you. You killed some of the most beautiful people I know. Every fiber of my body hurts, and I'll never be the same. May God have mercy on you. We will pray for you every day. We will pray for your parents and your family members every day. We will pray for your peace. We will show you grace. Why? Because that's what Jesus would do. I forgive you. You took something very precious from me. I will never talk to her again. I will never, ever hold her again. But I forgive you and have mercy on your soul. I forgive him and my family forgives him. But we would like him to take this opportunity to repent. Repent, confess, give your life to the one who matters most, Christ. He can change your ways. So no matter what happens to you, you'll be okay. For me, I'm a work in progress. I acknowledge that I am very angry right now. But one thing that my sister always enjoined in our family is that we are the family that love built. We have no room for hating, so we will have to forgive. Although my grandfather and the other victims died at the hands of hate, this is proof. Everyone's plea for your soul is proof that they lived in love and their legacies will live in love. So hate will not win. And I just want to thank the court for making sure that hate doesn't win. All this came days after a Wednesday night Bible study meeting that began like any other. A group of a dozen Christians met in their local church to pray and reflect. The 12 were all African American, and some were surprised to see a 13th white college-aged man show up. They welcomed him. The pastor invited him to sit beside himself. They sang. They prayed. They studied the Gospel of Mark. The young visitor listened at first, then started looking down at his hands. Perhaps he was mulling over the way his father abused his mother, or the 7 schools he'd attended before dropping out. Perhaps he was comparing this Bible study with what his evangelical Lutheran church preached. We'll never know. What we do know is that Dylan Ruth came to start a race war. But they forgave him. They prayed with him. They transformed his hate into their strength in a way that opened the hearts of others who were watching. Their children, neighbors, even other teenagers who might otherwise become radicalized by white America into believing that morality doesn't require vulnerability. And going back a little farther, when Charles Taylor, a warlord in Liberia, created a civil war in his country after the breakup of the Soviet Union and invaded neighboring countries in West Africa, this put whole societies into turmoil for more than a decade. And when the Civil War ended and Charles Taylor was brought to justice, it wasn't putting him on trial that brought peace and prosperity back to the peoples in Liberia and Sierra Leone, but rather it was a Truth and Reconciliation Commission would go from town to town and call upon the witnesses and the families of the victims to come forth and tell their stories and share what happened. This was more, I think the profound aspect of this was that in order for people to move forward as a people, they had to first grieve and express their emotions and agree upon a common narrative about what happened. And having done that, they could bury their differences. The families of the victims and the soldiers who fought under Charles Taylor and other warlords like him were still neighbors, and they had to figure out how to live together. Truth and Reconciliation is another form of restorative justice, the kind of thing that I consider to be effective activism. We never did that after the Civil War. We restored order. We didn't unite the peoples of this country. And because of that, something to think about, that we failed as a nation to carry out the third part of activism, to restore justice, to air the grievances, to create a common narrative about what happened, to accept our failures, and move forward united as a people. This is very different than the kind of thing that often gets aired by activists today. In the 1960s, those who were willing to put their skin in the game under Martin Luther King Jr. were asked to sign a 10-part pledge. And the first part of it was that they were not seeking victory. They were seeking justice. And there had to be a kind of justice in which dignity was ensured for the perpetrators of the violence. Victory would never end the conflict. There's a lot of talk about moral authority. Where are we asking our questions about how we get to moral vulnerability? The authority to speak about morality, the authority to speak about what's right and what's wrong, comes from our own vulnerability, our own sharing of our experience, our feelings, our fears, putting it all out there, our sacrifices, and indeed, airing what our community is, who we are as a people. You can start by standing with the people who are vulnerable and for whom your voice could be important. You can serve and protect them. And if you can do that, you can also show up in the public space and stand publicly to raise awareness for issues. Sharing our story is an act of vulnerability. Sharing our hopes and dreams with people with whom we know will disagree is a vulnerable, powerful act. Thinking about those people as human and thinking about the pain that they must have suffered, as in this clip the Reverend so eloquently explains.
I don't know about you, but sometimes I look at the news, it's hard for me to touch that place of compassion inside myself and say, oh my God, what a broken human being. What a warped, twisted, distorted person. How much hurt was inflicted on that individual to turn them into who I'm seeing today? It's hard for me to access that place of compassion in myself, but that is the only fuel that is really going to carry us forward to the ultimate vision we hold. The bedrock belief that Dr. King held was it's all about love. And the people who are oppressing, the people who are persecuting, they are suffering. They're suffering from a love deficit in their lives. And what we need to do is to fill them up with love, because brothers and sisters, when you're full of love, you can't oppress somebody, you can't hurt somebody, you can't harm somebody. When you're filled with love, it takes over your life. And you can't do anything but be loving and overflow with love. So Dr. King believed that the issue was a love deficit. He was embodying that greater love, that higher love, the love that will not let us go. And it was with compassion that he engaged the brokenness of the people who were oppressing in this country. And brothers and sisters, I'm here to tell you right now, if you do the work of spiritual transformation, your spirit, your heart, your mind will carry your feet out into the street to advocate for all the right and best things to do that advance human rights for all people, regardless of their skin color, their nationality, their religion, or their gender, or who they love. So.
Thinking about them as hurting, emotional, fully human people is the only way that we're going to bridge the chasm that has emerged between different sides. I'm not saying it's easy. I certainly struggle with it, and I don't really have any ideas on what to do every day to get better at that. But I know that we can't be activists for any cause if we haven't first dealt with our own difficulties in how we're going to be an individual witness. And an individual witness is someone who forgives, knowing full well that the person they're forgiving is guilty. But we're not here to be the judge. Imagine that we go through life not just as a human, not just as a human being, but as a living, breathing, eternal soul. A soul that walks the earth. Immortal, everlasting, without time. If we are a living soul, not bounded by time, we are not bounded by the tit-for-tat score of who's winning. The one thing that seems to matter to a soul that's eternal is the kind of transformation that comes from within that allows us to forgive, that allows us to see the dignity in all people, especially those with whom we disagree, and reach out to be an eternal soul and to remind ourselves daily of what that feels like and what really matters to our soul. That is what I think is at the basis of those people who were able to do restorative justice and reconciliation and work towards real peace. That's the effective activism that I'm looking for. That's why I started this podcast. I feel like that's the most important lesson. Whatever faith you practice, there's a spark of the divine in all of us, and a hope that we cling to. that kind of moral vulnerability, to be able to reach out to those with whom we have to make peace. And I think about this often whenever I see any movement, even a movement that I agree with strongly, like the Me Too movement. And right now, we're in the phase of outing the perpetrators. But that has to be a phase. It can't be the end. The next phase is how we deal with those perpetrators in a way that restores dignity to both the victim and to the abuser, and gives them a path towards reconciliation.